We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're pleased to have you with us, and we're happy to have here on the program as our guest once again, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We've been doing this program for a long time on a Monday to create an opportunity for people to ask questions about home maintenance issues. So maybe there's a problem and you're not quite sure how to approach it. We have talked about a lot of different things, heating and cooling, windows and doors, siding, roofing, basements, gutters. Oh, I'll stop. You get the idea. Just about anything that goes into the single-family home. So maybe something needs to be repaired. You're thinking about making some changes, doing some remodeling. Any and all of that is certainly open here. And I know Scott will do his best to give you an answer. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222. 9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too. And the address is will-talk. So that's willtalk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you, David. Good morning.
Is anything in particular on your mind at this point?
I was thinking sump pumps today.
Sump pumps.
Yes.
Good thing to be thinking about. Yeah exactly.
We've been having this beautiful weather with all the April showers. And sump pumps are something that if they're not working at this point, you probably already know it. But it's not a bad idea to check and make sure that you don't have any worn connections, loose connections. We'll let the sump pump go through a cycle, make sure we're not spraying out at any of the rubber connections. Look for where the sump pump discharges. Now, a lot of the newer homes, the sump pumps are discharging actually direct to a storm sewer or to a drainage area. But in the houses where the sump pumps were added later, most of them are still discharging out onto the surface, so you want to check that area, make sure that it's clear, the end of the pump hasn't blocked up, a rabbit hasn't decided to nest in the end of it, things like that. And make sure that where it's going to does drain out and away from the house so that that water that you just pumped out of your lower level doesn't end up running back through the foundation and back down to the sump pump again and working in a fountain fashion. So just something to think about with the wet weather. Make sure that works. Run it through a cycle. Lift the float. Make sure you don't have any oddball noises coming out of it. We still do have a few in this area that are connected to the city sanitary system, which is not correct. And they are supposed to be fixed and run out either to a storm sewer or to the surface. But every once in a while, I'll do an inspection and find one that somebody's connected up to a storm sewer or to a sanitary sewer. But, yeah, I just thought I'd bring that up as I was coming across town and had a couple puddles to drive through and watched one sump pump pumping directly out on the curb. That's also a no-no. You're supposed to not put them directly onto a sidewalk or curb. They're supposed to go out into some place where it can actually drain down.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, we have a caller here, and we'll start off with this listener, somebody in Champaign County, and this is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have porch steps that are constructed of treated lumber. They're about 25 years old, and at one time I thought it would be nice if they were the same color as the trim of the house, so I painted them. And I guess I didn't know there's a problem with painting treated lumber. I guess there is. But anyway, the paint sometimes adheres, sometimes it peels, etc. So yesterday I was out checking to see status, so then I found some deterioration, and I scraped some of this paint away, and I have some a lot of loose wood, and I'm not sure whether it's some moisture or a combination of moisture and ants or something else. So I just wondered if you had some recommended actions to prevent or treat this situation to prevent treated lumber from deterioration?
Well, treated lumber is treated so that it does resist water damage. Mm-hmm. If it stays wet, yeah, eventually it will rot. And after 25 years, I can imagine we do have a few boards that have some issues. It's hard to always get the chemicals pressured into the wood to get 100% coverage. The knots and things like that are denser, so they may not absorb as much, so we can get some damage. Really doubt that you've got ants or bugs getting into it, because generally the chemicals used to treat the pressure-treated lumber is not appetizing to the little bugs, so they usually try and stay out of it. Painting it does not necessarily help. First of all, we have injected chemical in there, but treated lumber also tends to stay fairly wet, and so paint does not like to adhere to it. Sometimes you can get by with stains, but you have to make sure that when you're staining a deck, it is very, very dry. You can't stain a new deck, but the stain will soak into the wood a little bit and give you a little bit longer lasting surface finish. If you've got a board or two that are rotted, about the only replacement is or only repair is to replace the boards. If you wanted to, again, make them more uniform in color, you can do, I hate to say a pressure wash, but for something like what you're describing, that's probably not a bad idea. When you wash things with high pressure, you really have to watch it, because if you get the wand too close to the lumber, it will actually damage the wood. But you can blow off or push off a lot of loose paint with a pressure washer. Now, not necessarily one of the high pressure one, gas powered ones, but you can get some spray nozzles for your garden hose that'll put out a pretty good force that should take off any loose paint. Otherwise, you may have to do a little bit of sanding and scuffing. You also have to remember that because the wood is exposed to sunlight, there is some UV deterioration. So there are some dead cells on top. So if you were to lightly sand the wood before you were trying to apply a stain, you'll get the stain soaking into the fresher cells, which are probably going to absorb a little bit better.
Yeah. Okay. And do you have a recommended stain or preservative to apply?
There are several of them out there. I don't have any one in particular that I use. Most of the stains nowadays have had enough research done that they seem to work relatively well with the pressure-treated lumber. So I would say you're pretty safe with most products that are out there.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, thank you for calling in.
One thing now, just am reminded of sometime in the past, talking with your dad about the kind of hardware that you should be using if you're going to build a deck with treated lumber. And I seem to remember something about how just regular galvanized nails, there was some reason why actually you needed to spend more and have something that it was a slightly higher level than that.
One of the agents used to treat the lumber is an arsenic, and it does react with a steel nail, and so it will deteriorate the nail. So for a while we're having to use stainless connectors. Mm-hmm. So you might want to check with the manufacturer of the pressure treated lumber as to what fasteners you would want to use to attach it. We haven't had a lot of problem with it in this area. Our temperatures are such that we dry things out enough that for the most part the lumber does dry down. Mm-hmm. Yes, we got a lot of rain too. It gets wet again, but really I have not found much in the way of fastener failure. But yes, for the arsenic treated lumber, a stainless steel fastener was recommended.
Okay. Our guest in this part of Focus, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month. It's always on a Monday. We talk about home maintenance. And if you have questions, you can give us a call. Lines are free, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And if you want, you could also send us an email. That might make it a little easier. That's will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. You were talking before about sump pumps. If you were going to put one in, is there anything particular you would suggest to people that they think about or look for if they're going to go out and buy one? As there's a pretty big spread in price. I mean, you can buy a real expensive one, you could buy a pretty cheap one.
There are several out there. It kind of depends on your application as to how many gallons per hour do we need to pump. If you've got a basement that's really, really wet, you need to go probably to a third horse pump versus a half horse pump. If you've got a basement that only gets wet occasionally, really the pump isn't as much of an issue. It's more of a safety factor to make sure we don't get any flooding. But I was in a home just about 2 weeks ago where they are on their third pump in 5 years. And at that particular point, I did recommend that rather than going to one of the big box stores and buying one of the more common sump pumps, to actually go to a plumber supply and get one that is a brass pump and one that has real bearings instead of plastic sleeves and things like that, because mm-hmm. they obviously had a significant water problem. They actually had a perched clay table that was draining water, and their pump ran on the average of over an hour a day, almost every day, whether it was raining out or not. Uh-huh. So, yes, he was going through pumps, sort of like, a lawn tractor. If you buy an inexpensive lawn tractor, it's great to do a small yard for 5 years, but if you try and do 5 acres, it lasts 1 year. The sump pump, the same way. If you buy the inexpensive sump pump, it works great for most of the time, but if it's something you need to run on a regular basis, you need to get a little bit more commercial duty unit.
All right. Champagne, here's a caller, line one. Hello.
Yes, sir. I have my bathroom sink. We had, of course, during the winter, the pipes froze, and we got, of course, them opened up by getting some warmth to the crawl space. But now I've got the water pressure. There is none. It's very, very, put both faucets to full blast, and you still get only a trickle.
Okay. The first thing I would check would be the aerator in the sink. There is a screw-in fitting at the end of the faucet that is designed to aerate the water. And if you had some pipe issues, it's very likely that you have some debris in that little screen that is at the top, and that will reduce it. So usually, sometimes they're finger tight. Oftentimes you'll have to get a pair of pliers and unscrew it. But just unscrew that little aerator unit and then turn the water on. If you get good water pressure there, obviously you either need to replace or clean that aerator. If you still do not have good water pressure, there's a very good chance that we've got a problem at one of the valves. I have found that some of the smaller shutoff valves that are installed, the rubber bushing inside of it turns sideways, and so that it has a very small opening and does not allow enough water to go through it. So we may need to have the water shut off to the house and then change the needle and seat and the little ball on the shutoff valve itself.
Okay.
So those are the two places I would check first. But first thing, make sure the water valve under the sink is turned all the way on, and then I would unscrew that aerator, and I'd be willing to bet that you'll find that's where your water restriction is.
All right. Thank you.
All right, thanks. So there could be enough little bits of stuff that collect in there that would prevent a good flow of water.
Yeah, I know particularly here in Champaign-Urbana, we do have one of our final filtering stages is a sand bed, and occasionally we can get a little bit of sand moving around. But there's always going to be some sediment in the water lines, the city water lines. Something happens in the area. Somebody fills a swimming pool, somebody checks a fire hydrant, we can dislodge some of this, and it'll actually work through the system and pick up into that little screened filter there at the aerator. So that's usually when you turn on the faucet and you only get a little bit out, it's not a lack of water pressure, it's a lack of water volume. So we're looking for a restriction someplace.
Okay. Well, again, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have questions on home maintenance for Scott Spies. Just for a second, back to the sump pump. Does it matter much where it's located? Would you generally, if you're coming into some place and there's no sump pump there, people say, well, we want to put one in, you would look around for about 2 seconds and say, okay, here. That it's that obvious?
Well, actually, when somebody calls me up and says, hey, I want to put in a sump pump, the first thing I'll say is, where's the water coming from?
Oh, okay.
Let's see if we can figure out where the water's coming from so we don't need to put in a sump pump. However, if we get past that step and we have determined that a sump pump is needed, ideally, since if we're putting them in a crawl space, we want it into one of the lower areas of the crawl space so the water wants to run to it. The biggest thing I see about sump pump installation that I'm not crazy about is somebody putting it in a 5 gallon bucket with a couple of holes drilled in it. Once you put a plastic bucket, a paint bucket or something down into the ground, first of all, it's not very deep. We're looking at maybe 15 or 16 inches. The pump itself takes up most of the volume of the bucket, so the pump float will rise very quickly. It takes very little water to fill the bucket because most of the bucket is full of pump. And so when the pump kicks on, it only runs for maybe 3 to 5 seconds to empty the bucket. You're much better off with a larger diameter sump to where we have a larger quantity of water. One of the keys to a long life on a sump pump is not very short, quick operations, but occasional running for, you know, 30, 40 seconds to drain, you know, 5-10 gallons of water actually out of the sump. There is a plastic corrugated sump that is available at most of the building stores that's roughly 20 inches in diameter by about 24 inches deep. Of course, every once in a while I find somebody that doesn't feel like digging the hole 24 inches deep, so they cut the top off of it. And again, reducing the volume in the sump means that when the pump kicks on, it pumps less water. So I do recommend sinking it the full 24 inches and putting the pump all the way down to the bottom, drilling a few holes in it so that the groundwater can come in. Ideally, if the sump pump is installed at the proper depth and we do have drainage to the sump, we will collect the water before it ever gets to the surface. So we actually drain the subsoils underneath our crawl space or underneath our basement floor, so we never have any water coming up to the floor.
Yeah.
A lot of people think, oh, well, I'm going to put the sump pump someplace where the water runs to. Well, hopefully if we got the pump installed right, we've got it low enough that it catches the water coming up before it ever ends up having to run where you can see it on the surface.
Okay. Another call here. We have some other folks, and we'll go to Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have a question for Rick. I am considering buying a house without doing a home inspection on it, and I'm just wondering what kind of risk I might be taking. An older gentleman had lived in that house until about 2 months ago, and he passed away and moved out, and I looked through the house, and it looks okay, but I was just wondering what you think about that.
Well, there's always, it's kind of a guess. It's sort of like buying insurance. You know, when you buy insurance, you're almost betting against yourself. I'm going to buy car insurance. That means I'm probably going to get a wreck and I want somebody else to pay for it. A home inspection is something where you get a trained professional, somebody that is used to looking at houses and knows what areas to look in. Quite often I'll find a little spot on a wall and go, oh, well, this could probably be a leak around a window up on a second floor. And people look at me cross-eyed and go, what? There is no way. And sure enough, we track it down because I've been in enough houses to where I can spot some little menial thing that is actually an indication of a problem elsewhere. So a home inspector who does, you know, a couple hundred houses a year, has some experience with looking for problems, will likely find more issues than someone who does a little bit of repair work here and there, because they wait until, they usually are called when there's been enough damage, a significant amount of damage, where something is quite obvious, rather than catching things before they become a big problem. Do you need a home inspection? No, there is no requirement to have a home inspection, but it's never a bad idea to have somebody with a little bit of knowledge. You don't necessarily need, particularly if you're buying an older home that is what we call an as-is condition or a family deal, we don't necessarily need somebody to go through there and say, oh, well, this outlet is upside down or the ground is missing there. But we want somebody to look for, okay, is there a chance that we've got some water damage behind walls or someplace that where moisture is getting in? Do we have some framing damage, things like that? Do we have mortar loose in the piers underneath the main supports? Items of that nature. Yeah, I've been on home inspections and had people say, well, I want you to find everything on this home. And it's like, okay, well, you know, the job of the home inspector is not necessarily to nitpick it to lower the price on the house, but more give you an idea of what kind of condition the house is in, and so you have an idea of what it's going to take over the years so you know what it is you're getting into.
Okay.
If you buy a car, you take it over to the mechanic and say, hey, check out the motor. You know, I can walk around the outside of it and make sure it's not dented, and I can look at the tires. But, you know, he may be able to listen to it and say, ooh, this thing's going to have some problems. Or he would know that particular model of car and say, hey, they're known for having a transmission problem. When a home inspector, we get into enough houses. Champaign, I really love all of our national homes. I can walk into a national home and I know all the construction. We've got multiple subdivisions that are nothing but national homes, which I hate to call them modular homes, but that's pretty much what they are. And I can tell you things about those homes and how they were built and what they look like inside the walls just because I've been in enough of them. So somebody that's familiar with the house and sees a lot of them can really give you a pretty good insight. You'd be surprised at what they can walk through and find.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
All right, very good. Thank you. And again, to Champagne, another caller. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. This isn't exactly a home question, but I figure you've been around people's landscaping when you check their homes. I have a rabbit problem where I live. I want to be able to go outdoors and walk around the lawn without walking in rabbit products. And I was wondering what kind of options you're seeing people use for dealing, for trying to fence out or barricade out rabbits.
Rabbits can be a little bit tricky to keep out because they do fit into some awful small spaces for their size. And so you have to use either a chicken wire type product or something that has got a fairly tight mesh. They can hop. As a general rule, they don't like to jump anything over about 5 or 6 inches high, so it's not like we have to make a 3-foot fence. But, you know, if you've got a garden and it's got some nice luscious leaves hanging out there, they're going to make a pretty good effort. They can burrow, so they can get underneath a fence, so you need something that goes all the way down to the ground. You can get a live trap to where you can actually bait the rabbits and catch them and release them elsewhere. I know in my neighborhood we have a few people with cats and dogs, and that seems to deter the rabbit population quite a bit, although it's not necessarily the recommended method.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know what area you're at. You might want to look into, okay, how is your lawn landscaped? Rabbits.
I'm at Ashland Park, and there's certain regulations about the fencing. Also, the topsoil goes down maybe 4 inches. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And then it's clay.
In that area there, north of town.
Mm-hmm.
Keep the lawn cut. Make sure we don't have a lot of areas for them to nest. When you've got rabbits, that usually means that they have they've found a favorite little habitat, some little area, uh-huh. some little obscure place where they can nest and they can breed. If you've got and I know in that area you've got a lot of little storage sheds out in the backyards
and neighbors' decks.
And yes, and the decks. Yep, they like those little sheltered areas, and they will proliferate pretty quickly.
Yes.
They make some small little decorative fences that are usually tight enough. Like I say, anything more than about 6 or 8 inches will usually keep them out. Unless you've got a food source such as a garden, then you may have to go up a little bit higher. Chicken wire is a relatively fine wire so that it doesn't look real obtrusive. If you're trying to put something around a deck, they do make some really nice lattice work panels, preformed, that you can cut to fit that would go from the deck down to the ground. And as long as you stick the end in the ground just a little bit, the rabbits will usually not try and get underneath them.
Thank you so much for your help.
No real easy way, but if you've got one going under a deck, you can actually see when you walk around where the trail is, and you can put one of the little Hartford live traps in there that will catch the rabbit, and you can take him out to the local park and release him over there. Relocating.
All right, thank you
for calling in.
We are at the midpoint of this hour of Focus. I'm David Inge, and Scott Spies is the guest. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and once a month he's on the program. It's always on a Monday. We talk about home maintenance, and if you have some kind of problem, you're not quite sure how to fix it, give us a call. He's been in a lot of houses, and he can give you the benefit of his advice. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email if you'd like to do that. The address is will-talk, that is W-I-L-L-talk. At illinois.edu. I know this is the kind of thing when Sandy Mason's been here, we've talked about rabbit issues. And if you have a garden you're trying to keep them out of, or if you have a particular plant, it is possible to screen off the plant if they're chewing on it. I think it might be kind of pretty hard if you just say, I don't want to see any rats. Any rats? Yeah, that's how some people. Any rabbits anywhere on my property. I think that might be kind of tough.
Yeah, that's going to require a fencing and, again, something with the bottom of the fence. Most wood fences do not like to be put directly in contact with the ground, so we tend to leave them up off the ground just a little bit to get a little air to them. That is the ideal location for the rabbits to sneak underneath there. And I've seen rabbits get into spots that just amaze me that they actually fit through that little hole and get into the spot. So something in the form of a little wire fence would probably be your best bet. Again, if you've got a deck where they're getting underneath, you can get the pressure-treated lattice work. I've actually seen it in wood or in vinyl and plastic that would not deteriorate, already in white, so you don't have to paint it. Your classic little picket white fence syndrome. We have to decorate the deck a little bit. But that will help getting them out from underneath there. We really don't want them running around under the decks because they do tend to burrow and create little holes. And then when we have water issues, the water wants to run down into the little burrow. And oftentimes it's next to the foundation, which then leads to our original topic this morning of sump pumps. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's... I know the area that she's referring to, it's a relatively new area. There's not a lot of trees and stuff, so they're looking for any man-made structure to try and nest under or trying to get to. Like, as I was going to point out, the next one is little storage buildings. The freestanding storage buildings are usually set on a 4x4 pressure-treated lumber, so they're up off the ground. Mm-hmm. Those are a prime habitat for not only rabbits, but possums and... I've even seen several raccoons come out from underneath one of those little buildings when looking closely.
Mm-hmm. Just for a second, go back to treated lumber, as you talked about fences and how they don't like to be touching the ground. And we had this earlier question from the caller who was had some wooden steps that were deteriorating. How many years service do you expect to get out of a piece of pressure-treated wood?
Well, it does vary with not only how much shade you've got by how damp it stays, but also with how much sunlight it gets as to how much cracking and deterioration. The lumber will usually last a lot longer than what it looks good. A lot of pressure-treated decks and walkways that are replaced because they just don't look nice anymore. The UV deterioration has caused the lumber to gray and crack and check. In some areas where we've got moisture underneath there, yes, we'll get some rot or some deterioration. Generally speaking, 20, 25 years.
Mm. To another caller, and it's somebody in Champaign, and this is line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yeah.
I have an outbuilding that has not been painted for a very long time. It still has a fair amount of paint on it, but it's been falling off and so forth. And a fair amount of the bare wood has been exposed to the sunlight for quite a while. And I'm thinking of siding it. And I'm wondering whether there's any point to going through the ritual of painting it first, or whether there's anything else that I should do before putting the siding on it.
I'm assuming you're talking about putting possibly a vinyl siding on it?
I haven't looked into the kind of siding yet, but vinyl, okay. Steel, or aluminum, whatever is... turns out to be best.
Since the wood is unprotected, the paint has come off of it, it's really not a bad idea to put a house wrap on it. A house wrap is a relatively inexpensive material which will allow water vapor through but not liquid. So when you put your siding on, if we have any water penetration around windows or doorway openings, things like that, that water does not get to the wood. Putting siding directly onto other wood siding does mean that you've got areas where we can actually hold moisture against the wood and create a water issue or a deterioration point. So putting a vapor barrier, or not a vapor barrier, a weather barrier such as a house wrap is usually a pretty good idea.
Okay, so this is a new concept to me. This is something I would go to someplace like Home Depot to get, or how does one do this?
They do sell the house wraps. Usually the roll is 8 or 9 feet tall, and you just kind of tack it in place and kind of walk it around the house, and then you cut it around the door openings and window openings and tape and seal it before you put your new siding down over the top of it. There's, depending on what type of a building you're doing and what your purpose for the building is, you can also get what we call fan fold foam sheathing, which is about 1/4 inch thick that we can put over the top of the old siding, and the foam sheathing will actually act as a little bit of a weather shield so that we don't get the water in behind the siding. Is this a garage or just a storage building or something that we're trying to close up and seal up?
It's a garage.
Okay. Probably the easiest and least expensive way would be to put in the house wrap all the way around there. That would also help reduce a lot of the air leakage, so the garage would end up staying warmer just from the heat generated from the concrete slab.
Okay. And in the part of it, there's has a gable roof, so how does one wrap the triangular piece?
The upper portion?
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll just end up having to go over it and then cut the house wrap to fit.
I see. And then it tapes fast, I guess?
They make a special tape that will tape the large sections of the house wrap to each other, a Typar or Tyvek plastic tape, which works quite well. Basically, once you put the house wrap on, the tape holds the seams until you get the siding on. When you put your siding on, the nails and such for the siding and the siding pinching the paper to the old siding will hold it in place.
I see. Is all this something that the siding people would know all about and be able to carry out?
Yes. The siding people do put on the house wrap. Most of them, or a lot of them I've found, don't seem to put it on garages, but I do highly recommend it, particularly in a case like where you've got, where we do have something that could rot or deteriorate behind the siding, so we need to put something to help protect it.
Okay. And do you have a recommendation about vinyl versus aluminum versus steel?
Well, the steel lasts longest, but it does dent and can rust where you put nails and such through. The aluminum goes up fairly easily. It dents a little bit easier, but it lasts for quite some time. Vinyl, generally speaking, if you're looking for bang for the buck, the vinyl siding is the fastest, easiest, cheapest stuff to put on and does have a good track record as far as life. So I would say from a price standpoint versus durability, the vinyl siding is a good bet.
Okay, what kind of durability would one expect from that? What kind of lifetime?
It is not unusual to see vinyl siding 30, 40 years old.
Oh, okay. It'll outlast me. Okay, thanks a lot. That's very helpful.
Very good. Thank you. Thanks for the call. I just got an email from somebody who was listening to our rabbit discussion, and here's a suggestion that apparently the person who was listening found in a catalog a product that is what it is. It looks like a cat. It looks like a silhouette of a cat, and it's made out of black enameled metal. It's not terribly expensive. This one came from a place called Whatever Works. And listener says that she has, in fact, found it to work. You just stake it out there. It should be good to be out in all kinds of weather. They put some kinds of shiny thing in where the eyes would be, and I guess it's realistic enough to scare away pests like rabbits and keep them out of the yard. So that would be something they could try, I guess.
I did mention that we do have that cats and dogs in the neighborhood does tend to make for less rabbits in the neighborhood. So, yes, a cat decoy would probably work well, as would a plastic owl.
Essentially, yes, that is what we're talking about. I think that that's also part of the issue is that they're just in a lot of places. There aren't a lot of predators.
Yep.
That are, although interestingly enough, I think because now more and more in urban areas, we're starting to see large raptors like hawks. There, I have seen them go after rabbits, but that's probably not really enough. If you have a big rabbit problem, it's not going to do it.
It wasn't that long ago when over my parents' house by the Champagne Country Club, we saw a little red fox lounging around in somebody's backyard. So a little town fox.
All right. Well, in any case, folks could try that and see how it works, and you can report back to us. Otherwise, you had questions here for Scott Spies, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And we are moving into about our last 15 minutes. The temperatures have been really up and down. We have had a few fairly warm days, but generally it's been pretty cool so far this spring. And I would think that probably we wouldn't get into really consistent warm temperatures, maybe not for another 3 weeks or 4 weeks. But if people are thinking about that, have not run their air conditioning since last fall or summer or whatever. Is there anything that you would suggest people might want to do just to check it out?
Most of the time, the air conditioners do fairly well, but if you've got one that is getting up in age or one that you have some concerns as to its condition or its operable status. Yes, this is a very good time to contact one of these service people because they are not terribly busy. They're not getting emergency calls saying I have no heat, as a general rule, and they're not getting emergency calls saying my house is sweltering. So this is what I'll call a lull or a slow time. It's actually a big installation time for new construction and such for them, but it is also a time when you can usually get them to come out and schedule it rather than have to make an emergency call, which is it's always kind of nice to be able to say, hey, can you come in on Wednesday instead of, oh, my gosh, I have this problem. Can you come in yesterday?
Yeah. So, and maybe also it's the time if you don't have air conditioning, you're thinking about it rather than waiting until July to call the person. Maybe now wouldn't be such a bad idea to start getting your estimates and thinking about if that's what you really want to do.
Yeah. So, yeah, of course, changing your filter does make a big difference. You're supposed to change your filter about 4 times a year. So when I usually like to remind people at the fall and spring, when you switch from heat to cool, that's a good time to check the filter. Then one time in between in the season, just to make sure that we've got good airflow, because the key to the efficiency of the air handling system, if you've got a forced air unit, is how much air can we move past our cooling coil or how much air can we move past our heating coil.
Okay. Some other callers here. Urbana, next, line one.
Hi.
Hi.
I don't know if you covered this. I just tuned in, but my deck surface is a mess. Now, what happened was I had someone put a preservative preservative may not be the precise word, but to coat it, and it didn't cover well, and so I had someone who was probably more professional come and do it. But apparently, one was oil based and one was water based.
Mm-hmm.
And so, basically, that would have been a couple of years ago. So now it's very spotty. Some places it looks like bare wood, and some places it looks kind of brownish, like maybe there's a stain or something on it. And I don't know what to do at this point. This is a north-facing deck.
Well, probably I would start with one of the commercially available deck washes. They actually make a wash that basically has a little bit of oxalic acid in it, which will help to remove dead cells from the wood, also help remove some of the paint. A good stiff bristle brush. Now, this is a labor-intensive unit. You know, we're going to have to spray it down with a deck wash and then get a good stiff brush and try and knock loose any finish that was not adhered well. If you can't get it even, then you basically have two different options. One would be sanding, which sanding, of course, most people doing sanding don't like to do decks because they have too many metal nails sticking up, which really it wreaks havoc on their sanders and the sandpaper and the people trying to do the work. And the other one would be to go to a colored stain, an opaque stain, something that has a tint to it so that we end up just basically covering over it. I would not put, again, a paint on a pressure-treated lumber. I would put a stain.
Right. Now, they were stains, but it was just the problem that one was oil-based and one was latex-based, I guess. I don't know. That one of them never dried properly, and the guy told me, oh, yeah, it's going to dry. But it didn't. It remained sticky. So I think that was the top one.
Okay. Well, yes, it does not work well to put an oil-based product over the top of a latex product.
Yeah, we were just unaware of that.
Yeah, if you have a latex product down, then putting an oil-based, what happens is the oil doesn't soak down into the wood, and so it doesn't work as well. And
right.
So, like I say, they do make some commercially available deck washes, which have a very high detergent that will help take most of that off. Good stiff bristle brush, and then, like I say, if you can't get it even enough to your satisfaction, then about the only other thing to do is go over it with another layer of an opaque latex-type stain.
Yeah. Are there people who are willing to do that? There's no way that I'm capable of...
that's a good question. You could call some of the deck companies that do mostly construction work, or you can try and go with one of the handymen that... kind of a jack of all trades Yeah, I don't have anybody in particular that I would recommend.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, very good.
Thank you.
Bye. We'll go on here to another caller. And this is Champagne, and it's line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I'm calling with a question about flooring, vinyl flooring, actually. We currently have vinyl sheet flooring and are contemplating putting in vinyl tiles as a replacement. My concern is the possibility of dirt and water getting in on all the surrounding seams of the tiles. The tiles can be put either, they can have grout used, or they can also be installed groutless, so there's no grout or no seam sealer. So I wonder if you have any experiences with that, and if my concern is a valid one about getting dirt in the spaces around each tile.
Depending on the adhesives used to secure the tiles in place, yes, that can be a problem. Most of the better quality tiles do have an adhesive which, when you put them together, will tend to flow or seep and fill in that crack and give you and then dry to a hard enough surface where we don't really get the dirt underneath there. But I have seen some of the thinner and lesser expensive tiles where the adhesive never really sets up and the dirt tends to stick to it, and so you end up with the black lines around it. So I would have to say that the quality of the job is going to depend a lot on the quality of the material used. So if you use a good quality tile, it shouldn't be as much of a problem. And you're saying a groutable tile, so I'm assuming we're looking at a pretty thick vinyl tile. So, again, it's going to depend on what kind of a mastic we use to actually secure it in place. Are you trying to put this over the top of the existing vinyl, or are you putting down another layer of new
actually, on? Yes. The installer said that it would be fine. They have to equalize the surface over the existing vinyl by putting something on and then install it over the existing vinyl sheet vinyl.
All right. Well, in that particular case, I don't know that I've had any experience with trying to do that. I know I've tried to put sheet vinyl over the top of other things, and unless you put a layer of glue on it, just telegraphs every pattern and everything underneath it. So he's correct in that he does have to put something over the top to level it, because vinyl is a flexible enough material that it will conform to whatever is underneath it, which will tend to shadow or show through the new product.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
they
ensured us that, and this is a professional installer, that they put on something to level over the whole floor, and it levels any indentations or anything else in the floor, so you end up with a surface that's smooth enough to install a new vinyl on top of it.
In that particular case, I would say you're probably going to be all right. I don't think you're going to get the depth between the tiles to create the dirt problem.
Okay. And so actually you said that the adhesive that adheres the new vinyl tile actually seeps up between those lines?
Well, it doesn't come up to where it's raised. What it does is it kind of flows to level out. When the adhesive is fresh, it's got a little bit of viscosity to it, so it's got just a little bit of flow or ebb, and it will tend to, you know, if they haven't got it completely tight or if there's a slight gap, it will tend to seal up the gap. It's not going to come up, and it's not going to be where it will have to wipe up the adhesive, but it'll be just enough to seal the joint between the tiles so that we don't get the dirt down in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And does the same hold true for water, if you simply scrub the floor with a wet rag?
If you're doing a damp mop, you should be fine. Obviously, the idea of dumping an entire bucket on there and letting it sit for a while is not a good idea. But most of the adhesives used are very water resistant, so it shouldn't be a problem.
Okay. And then I have a second question about skylights. Are you familiar with solar shades, and do they work?
Depending on the application, they can work well. You say it's a skylight, so I'm assuming that we're in an area where we don't have trees and such directly overhanging the skylight. So you're getting a lot of, first of all, you're getting some really nice solar gain, but you're also probably getting some UV deterioration. In other words, the carpets and stuff can stain because of the amount of sunlight. So the solar shades generally will allow the light in but help reflect the UV rays so that you do reduce some of the deterioration, some of the damage done by the bright sunlight. Several of them have variable densities so that you can determine how much light you want to let in. And yes, I do believe that a shade on a skylight is a good idea.
Uh-huh. Okay. And you said they possibly come with varying densities?
Yeah, so you can block off certain amounts of light. So you, depending on, you know, how much darker you want the room, whether you want the full sunlight or the bright sunlight, you know, not, sort of like a Venetian type shade, but they come in a different, I don't know how to describe, a different porosity. Most mm-hmm. of the solar shades actually have small pinholes through them.
Yeah, I understand.
And they have some that will block more than others.
Hmm.
So you might want to take a look and see just how much light you can get through them.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much.
Well, the other thing would be is you probably don't want to leave your solar shades closed in the evening in the wintertime, because we want to be able to get some air past the skylight so we don't get condensation. If the window gets quite cold, we can get a little bit of moisture condensation. So ideally, they should be open or away from the window in the cold wintertime during the day.
Oh, okay.
At evening, when we're obviously not worrying about blocking the sun.
Yeah, right. No, the main function was to use them during the day when the sun is at its high point and prevent the UV rays from getting in and damaging things in the room.
They make window tints that can go over the top of that will have the UV qualities built into it, reflective mm-hmm. qualities, or as the sunshades. If you put the sunshades on, like I say, the one thing, when you get really cold days, particularly when it goes from a mediocre day to a very cold day and you've got a high humidity in the house, you can get some condensation on your skylight, so I do like to see them opened in the evenings.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Maybe about 3-4 minutes left. Someone wants to call real quick. We'll get the question in. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just on the subject of flooring, particularly for kitchens, because I expect kitchen floors probably get the most abuse of just about any floor in the home. Stuff gets spilled on it. Stuff gets dropped on it. People with muddy feet go through there. Mm-hmm. You know, they take a lot of abuse. Do you have... And there are a variety of flooring materials, both natural and synthetic, that I guess that you can get depending on what it is you want it to look like. Any strong feelings about what really makes for a good kitchen floor?
Well, you need something that is water resistant. Wood floors work, but they require a lot of maintenance. If you've got an older home, or if you want to put in a real wood floor, you've got to be willing to do the maintenance, clean it up and mm-hmm. refinish it if necessary. The laminate floors seem to do quite nicely. However, if you get a long-term water leak, such as a water line for the refrigerator starts to seep or something you don't catch right away, it does get underneath there and can cause some swelling problems. And so therefore, probably the most durable is the vinyl, which is not really affected by the water, unless, of course, we get the water underneath there where it softens the adhesive and starts curling it from the backside. So it kind of depends on what you want. Just remember, it is a floor covering, so eventually it may need to be replaced.
Yeah. One more caller here, at least. This is Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yes, following up on the questions about putting the siding on the outbuilding. Is there a season of the year or weather situation that's more or less favorable for doing that kind of work?
Actually, you probably don't want to do it when it's really, really cold, and you don't want to do it when it's really, really hot. The siding does have expansive qualities, particularly vinyl. It expands quite a bit when it's hot, and it shrinks quite a bit when it's cold. So you want to put it in on a day when it's relatively average, so that we don't have. You know, if you put it on when it's really hot, somebody will probably cut it a little short, and when it gets cold, all of a sudden the siding unlaps at the ends because the vinyl shrinks enough, it moves that we no longer have full coverage. So you want to get it while the siding is about what we'll call a mean temperature or normal temperature.
Okay. Are the contractors, as a result of the current economic conditions, are they unbusy or are they busy?
It varies. We're not building as many new homes at the moment, but in retrospect, because people aren't buying new homes, they are fixing up their older homes. So most of the contractors may not have as many large projects going, but may have a multitude of small projects built up and backlogged.
Okay. And the final thing, I don't have much experience in this area. I know you can't make recommendations of particular contractors over the air, but how would a person go about making a choice?
I would probably contact a couple of contractors and then ask for some references and call some of the clientele that they've done some work for.
Okay. There isn't any...
I don't know of any reference guide or anything for contractors now.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thanks
all
a lot.
All right. We'll see if we can get one more, and this will be line number two and Champagne. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. Mike, this is your neighbor, Joy. I have lots of tulips. I cannot help spreading the word in regard to the question of rabbits. I use a product called Thiram. That's not a brand name. It's a chemical, T-H-I-R-A-M. Highly recommended to me by the University Horticulture Department. They use it on their berries, and nothing dies. Unfortunately, among nurseries, not only in town but online, there's a rumor going around that this stuff is poison. It is definitely not, as I say. A horticulture professor told me we use it on the berries, and it doesn't poison anything. It just tastes terrible to rabbits, and it is systemic. It sticks in the plant. So please spread the word, Thiram. Thank you.
All right. Well, very good. Thank you. That may indeed be helpful. People might want to try it. We'll have to stop there because we're here at the end of the show. My apologies. We have somebody we just can't take. But we've got to wrap it up for right now with the promise that in a month, Scott will be back. Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service is with us once a month on the program. It's always on a Monday. I do believe it's the third Monday.
Usually we try for the third Monday.
That's what, so you can look for Scott on the third Monday, and it's going to be May. I can't hardly believe it. He'll be back then. And we want to say thank you very much for being
right.
here.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
All right.